There was a mountain woman, at least as the story is told some time ago, that was attending a foothills little church, and about halfway through the sermon she stood up and started walking out with her baby, and as she got up into the aisle the baby started screaming, and the preacher said, "Stop, lady, stop." He says, "Your baby screaming isn't disturbing me." And she turned around and looked at the preacher and she says, "Yeah, but I think you're disturbing him." You know, I'm not so sure that that baby doesn't represent the biggest percentage of our population today. Real, down-to-earth Bible preaching disturbs people. People, for the most part, don't want to hear. They don't want to know. They don't want, for the most part, even to be warned about impending danger. Turn with me, if you would, to Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 17, which verifies the fact it was the case in the time of Jeremiah as well. Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 17. 6 and 17, it says, "Also I set watchmen," listen carefully, "I also set watchmen over you, saying, hearken to the sound of the trumpet." What was the trumpet for? Well, in many cases it was for a warning to the people. And so he says, "Hearken to the sound of the trumpet," but then notice what happens. It says, "But they said, we will not hearken." It was the blowing of the trumpet, it was a warning to them, and yet they still said, "We will not hearken." I'm reminded of King Ahab in 1 Kings chapter 22, when Syria was preparing to go to war with Israel, and all the false prophets were preaching peace and prosperity. And Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, inquired of King Ahab. They were going to have a union, the king of Israel and the king of Judah. And King Jehoshaphat inquired of King Ahab and said, "Is not there a prophet of Yahweh amongst the people that we can inquire of him?" All the other prophets, they were prophets. "Oh, you're going to have victory." You might remember, they all talked, they put horns on their head and they were acting it out and acting like they were just going to rout the Syrians. Peace and prosperity, peace and prosperity. Yet Jehoshaphat said, "Wait a minute, is there not a prophet of Yahweh that we can inquire of to see whether he'll confirm what's going on?" To which Ahab replied to that question. He said, quote, "There is yet one man, Micah, the son of Imlah, by whom we may inquire of Yahweh. Yet I hate him, for he does not prophesy good concerning me, but evil." Ahab simply didn't want to hear anything negative, even when listening would have saved him his own life. I'm sure many of you have experienced it. You sit down with someone, burdened to let them know what's going on around them, burdened to let them know what's being done to them. And the moment you begin to share with them, the doors go up and the shutters come down. And you can just tell, you just know, that it's time to go on to some nice platitudes. It's time to go on to the weather or to talk about the children. It happened not too long ago, a couple weeks ago, that I was sharing with someone just simply that the Walt Disney subliminals, that Walt Disney, that Eisner and his ilk and his bunch are putting subliminals into many of the children movies. And maybe it's been happening all along. Good chance that it's been happening for some time. But some of the recent cartoon movies, they've been exposed in what they were doing. This is not part of the message, but I'll share with you. I can't remember if I've shared this with you before. But for example, in the movie Lion King, there's a place, and I've verified both of these. I can tell you right where it's at, so if you can see it, you can see it or hear it yourself. There's a place in the movie, the cartoon movie Lion King, where about three-fourths of the way through the movie, the young lion, after he's grown up, is about to go back and take over the kingdom. But just before he does, he's kind of, I think, going into a state of contemplation about the situation. And he's on the top of a little bluff, and he plops down, and there's some dust that rises up on each side of him. And it kind of swirls and gets sparkly and makes a nice, pretty cloud. Well, there was a purpose for that cloud. Because in that cloud, if you look at it, you'll find that there's a subliminal. and it says sex. I heard that on KOA one morning, that there were claims of that, so we got the movie out and played it until I found the spot, and sure enough, my children, once you point it out, it's there to be seen, that it writes out sex real pretty in that nice cloud. Also in the movie Aladdin, I had heard that there's a place where he's entering the balcony. Again, I found this spot, and it's very, very evident once you hear it. It's not even disguised, but it's just very low. But there's a place at the time when he's on the balcony, and he's trying to bid the princess who's in her chamber. And at one point, he says very lowly, "Take off your clothes." And again, who knows if those two things are, or each of those is in each of those movies, who knows what else may be in those movies and many others as well. But that's all I was trying to explain or share with this person. And that was enough. The doors closed, doors came down, and the shutters went up. You know, just something that simple. You know, I get so frustrated with meaningless conversation with people. Not that sometimes you don't want to talk about the children, and sometimes you don't want to talk about the weather, maybe just to get things started. But I get so frustrated with just simply meaningless conversation, and I can understand why God gets so disturbed with meaningless repetition in prayer. It's maybe a little bit different, but nonetheless, I can understand it, because I get disturbed and frustrated with, again, meaningless talk that gets you nowhere in this day and time. But why? Why don't people want to know the truth? I received a letter just a day or two before I prepared this message from somebody on the tape ministry, and he wrote, quote, "It's sad that people are so asleep, actually intolerant of new knowledge, new truth. It seems that they're saying, don't bother me with truth," end of quote. He's just frustrated. He's just newly frustrated with a frustration that I think every one of us in this room have had at one time or another in the past. But why? Why is it that people don't even want to be warned? I often have wondered about that, and I think that I've come up with at least a few possible reasons. First, the fact must be faced that some people would rather simply have their ears tickled. We know that. You don't have to accept my word on it. Most of you are familiar with 2 Timothy 4 and verses 3 and 4, so we won't turn to it. But in the New American Standard Version, it says, verse 3, "For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine," truth, "but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires, and will turn away their ears from the truth, and will turn aside to myths." I think, why? Why would people want to throw away truth just simply to have their ears tickled? Well, I don't know any other answer other than they just want their ears tickled. Turn to Isaiah 30. There's a similar passage there. It says very, very nearly the same thing, but a little bit differently. Isaiah chapter 30 and verses 8 through 11. Beginning with verse 8, it says, "Now go write it before them in a table, and note it in a book, that it may be for the time to come forever and ever." And then verse 9, "That this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of Yahweh." And then verse 10, "Which say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak to us smooth things, prophesy deceits. Get you out of the way, turn aside out of the path, because the Holy One of Israel," caused the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. We have people saying that today. Maybe not literally. I don't know if they had it literally happening then either. But nonetheless, it's happening, isn't it? Because they will not tolerate. There are so many people who simply will not tolerate truth. And what do they do with the preachers if the preacher starts getting out of line and starts preaching truth? Now they drum up a movement to boot the preacher out. I've been booted twice out of churches for that very reason. You don't preach truth in most places without getting the boot in this day and age. It's the same thing. They may not literally say that, but their actions certainly show that it's true. Jeremiah 5, verses 30 and 31. It's the same thing. It says, King James Version, a wonderful, much better translated in the New American Standard as if I can read my appalling. I can hardly read my writing. An appalling and horrible thing is committed in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely, and the priests bear rule by their means. That's bad, isn't it? Isn't it bad that the prophets prophesy falsely and the priests bear rule by their own means? But let me tell you what's worse. And my people love to have it so. That's worse. Why is that? Well, maybe it's because that the people instinctively know that truth does not come cheap. There's a price to pay with truth. It may be your friends. It may be your family. It may be your lifestyle. To some, it meant their very life itself. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 18, it says, "For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow." That's a fact. You know, there are times that I wouldn't trade it for the world, but there are times that I sometimes wish I didn't know what I know, because there's a price that comes with it. I wouldn't trade it away. Don't misunderstand me. But it's a fact. But let's not forget that there's another side to it as well. Again, Ecclesiastes, "For in much wisdom comes much grief, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow." But Proverbs 16:20 puts the balancing side to it, where it says, "Understanding is a wellspring of life unto him that hath it." But there's a price to pay. Indeed, it's the wellspring of life. But there's a price to pay that comes with truth. It must also be faced that God has planned it so. That's right, as difficult as it may be to believe, God does not intend for everyone to respond positively. Now again, that wouldn't be according to the majority of what you'd hear preached across this land. That just simply doesn't fit in. But that is a fact. Turn to Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah chapter 6, God does not intend for everyone to respond positively. Listen to this, beginning with verse 8. In verse 8, "Also I heard the voice of the Lord, saying, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Isaiah speaks, and he says, Then said I, Here am I, send me. And oh, for more Isaiahs in the world today. And continuing, and he said, "Go and tell this people," God is speaking, "Hear ye indeed, but understand not. Hear ye indeed, but understand not. And see ye indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert and be healed." The same is repeated at least twice in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, in chapter 28, and turn also to Mark chapter 4. Now, this may be just almost redundant here, but let me read it again from the New Testament. Mark chapter 4, beginning with verse 10. Verse 10, "And when he was alone, they that were about him with the 12 asked him the parable." Of course, it's the he here is Yeshua. "And he said unto them, Unto you it is given." He had just given them some of the kingdom parables. They were the seekers and the searchers. They were coming and they said, "We don't understand any more than the rest of them. We want to know what you're talking about." And so he responds in verse 11, "And he said unto them, Unto you it is given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God, but unto them that are without, all these things are done in parables, that seeing they may see and not perceive, and hearing they may hear and not understand, lest at any time they should be converted and their sins should be forgiven them." We may not understand that. I can say I don't understand that completely. God, you think God would want all converted. But it's very clear from those passages, Old and New Testament alike, that that is not the case. And we may not understand it, and it may not fit our current idea about God, but nonetheless, it is a fact. This is one of the reasons that we must content ourselves in being seed planters and waterers. Because only God can bring the increase. As Christ said in Matthew 15, Every plant which my Father does not plant is uprooted. In other words, it isn't his intent. We need to scatter the seed because we don't know. I mean, there have been people like the Apostle Paul who you'd have thought never in the world would they be converted. I'm sure there were people who thought that of me at times. So we just need to scatter the seed, but we need to understand that God is the one who brings the increase, and we need to be content with our job and not with anything else. Here's another possible reason that most people may not want to be warned. They're simply not used to it. True watchmen on the wall are rare. And so people just aren't used to being warned. Sadly, the vast majority of today's preachers fit the description provided by Yahweh through the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 56 and verse 10 of ignorant, blind watchmen, dumb dogs unable to bark. A lot of people would never even think that's probably found in the Scriptures, but you can check it out for yourself, Isaiah 56 and verse 10. But that is a much better description for most of our preachers than simply watchmen on the wall. Ezekiel 22 and verse 30, Yahweh pointed this out. He said, I sought for a man among them that they should make up the hedge and stand in the gap before me for the land, that I should not destroy it. He was looking for those true, rare watchmen on the wall. And he said, I sought for a man to be there, to hedge, to stand in the gap. You know what's so sad about that passage? He said, I sought for them, but I found none. Whatever situation he was talking about, I'm sure it was in a limited sense to some degree, but wherever he was looking for it to happen, he couldn't find one single man. One man who, like Isaiah would say, here am I, Lord, send me. Reminds me of the passage, I forget where it's at, but it reminds me of the passage where it says, the eyes of Yahweh are moving to and fro throughout the earth, that he may strongly support those who are his. You know, he's got to search. His eyes are moving to and fro throughout the earth because he just can't look down and say, well, there they are. They're so obvious. He's got to look for them. They're so rare. Consequently, so with so few true watchmen, when the alarm is blown or the trumpet is blown by someone, the people don't know how to react. Oh, what was that? What was that? I don't know what that was. Because there's so few giving true warnings from God's Word. The trumpeter becomes an oddity, an extremist, a radical in the minds of the people. Because they're not the norm out there. And with that, there are also few who want to be watchmen on the wall. I mean, after all, who wants to be considered weird or worse? And who wants to put their families through what comes with being a watchman on the wall? Not very many. But for the few who have been truly called to it, they have no choice. Although I've been put through nothing comparable, I can say that there have been times in my life when I have felt a kindred spirit with Jeremiah. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 20. Jeremiah 20 and verse 9. And there he says, then I said, I will not make... Listen to what he says. This is Jeremiah speaking. He says, I will not make mention of him. Jeremiah said, I don't want to talk about him. At least part of him was saying that. Nor speak any more in his name. Can you blame the poor guy? I mean, I feel that of all the prophets, most of them went through some terrible times, but I feel I have the most compassion for Jeremiah. Now, there may have been ones that were even worse. There certainly were, I guess. There were some who were put to death. Jeremiah had to live through it. You think about all that he went through and all the preaching that he did. And you can understand why he said, man, I don't want to. Every time I talk, I speak in the Lord's name, or every time I proclaim him, man, I just get thrown into a dirty, slimy old well or something. He says, man, I don't want to do it anymore. But then it says, but his word was in my heart as a burning fire shut up in my bones. And I was weary with forbearing or for holding it in. You know, it's part of him was saying, I don't want to preach it. But Jeremiah says, I've got no choice. It's like a burning coal in my heart. I've been called to be a watchman on the wall, and no matter what the price, I've got to preach the word. Or as the apostles once declared in Acts chapter 4 and verse 20, where they said, "For we cannot stop speaking what we have seen and heard." And again, they had already been imprisoned, beaten, spit upon, and ridiculed and persecuted. And they came out and they said, "Boys, do whatever you want to do to us. We can't stop speaking what we've seen and heard." And when you have truly seen and been moved by the living, resurrected Christ, what else can you do but to say, I've got to share it. I've got no choice. Well, in that light, and in light of the fact that I don't want anyone's blood upon my hands for failing to provide the warning, I plan to spend the rest of this message, and most likely, hopefully, the rest of my life, blowing the trumpet, warning you and others of the things which God in His Word has told us to beware of. Just what is it that God has tried to warn us of? Now, there really aren't that many things. Matter of fact, I didn't know this. When I went into this, I figured it would just maybe be a pretty long series, because I figured that there would be just a horrendous number of things in the Bible that God has told us to beware of. But there really are not that many things that we have been told to beware of, using the word. And not that there aren't some other words, some other even Hebrew or Greek words that have been translated with other words, but looking just strictly at the words beware of. There are only, that word is found, beware or beware of, is only found used 28 times in the entire Bible. In the Old Testament, it's translated from the Hebrew word shamar, and it's a very interesting word. Here's the definition from Strong's Concordance. Shamar, a primitive root properly to hedge about. That's quite a study in itself. It's an interesting study to study about hedging. Remember Job, he talked about a hedge of thorns of protection. And it's something I encourage people to do, is that we need to pray hedges of protection around our families, especially the heads of our households. I do, maybe not every morning, but almost every morning I pray a hedge of protection around my household, around each of my wife, name each of my children by name, that God would hedge them and protect them from anything that would want to harm them, spiritual, physical, or otherwise. Well, this word is the word that deals, has to do with hedging. Again, a primitive root properly to hedge about as with thorns, i.e. guard, generally to protect and to attend to. Now, out of the 10 Old Testament occurrences, only 2 out of those 10 warnings or passages where we find the word beware of or phrase beware of used, only 2 are general warnings to God's people that would fit any time in history. Most of the other 8 are warnings like beware of King Sennacherib, which obviously was only applicable to that period in time that Sennacherib lived. Only 2 are general warnings. And it's noteworthy that the very first pertinent warning is one which tells us, where would you want to begin? Where do you think God would begin with a beware? What do you think would be the very first thing He'd tell us to beware of? Well, the very first one that's used is to tell us to beware lest we forget Him and His laws. Turn with me, if you would, Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 11. It says, "Beware that thou forget not Yahweh thy God in not keeping His commandments and His judgments and His statutes which I command ye this day." Now notice how that's worded. Now, I didn't even catch this until I just read it this time. Can you miss one little word? Can change the whole thing here. "Beware that thou forget not Yahweh thy God." It doesn't say "and." It says "in not keeping His commandments, His judgments, and His statutes which I command you this day." That was my very next point. I didn't realize that passage says it itself. We're told in that particular verse, the first general warning of beware, to that lest we forget Yahweh in His commandments, not end His commandments, which are one and the same. But first of all, how many today are heeding that warning? How many preachers today are heeding that warning? Not only are they forgetting Yahweh's laws, and thus, in essence, as that very verse proves, forgetting Yahweh Himself, since the very essence of God is His morality, and His morality is encountered in His laws. But not only are many preachers today forgetting His laws, but as the prophet Zechariah declared, they're even doing violence to His law. Also, Ezekiel 22. Let's turn there. I've used the Zechariah passage recently. Let's turn to Ezekiel 22. Ezekiel 22 in verses 25 and 26. It says, "There is a conspiracy of her prophets in the midst thereof, like a roaring lion ravening the prey. They have devoured souls. They have taken the treasure and precious things. They have made her many widows in the midst thereof." Verse 26. "Her priests have violated," New American Standard, "done violence to my law, and have profaned my holy things. They have put no difference between the holy and profane, neither have they showed difference between the unclean and the clean, and have hid their eyes from my Sabbaths, and I am profaned among them." There's a conspiracy of her prophets and priests. And he begins by saying that they have done violence to my law. How much more violence can someone do to God's law than to say that it's been abolished, that it's been nullified, and that's no longer in effect today? You can't do any more violence than to try to abolish His laws. It's interesting that the very same Hebrew word, shamar, translated beware in Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 11, is also numerous times translated to keep or to observe in relation to God's laws, to hedge. Deuteronomy 4 verses 1 and 2. Some cases it's translated beware, here it's translated keep. Deuteronomy 4 verse 1, "Now therefore hearken, O Israel, unto the statutes and unto the judgments which I teach you, for to do them, that ye may live, and go in and possess the land which Yahweh, God of your fathers, giveth you. You shall not add unto the word which I command you, neither shall you diminish aught from it." Well, we've got a lot of people. I mean, we may have plenty of preachers adding to the word. That's pretty common. But I tell you, we got plenty of them diminishing it as well, especially when it comes to God's very law. His morality. "You shall," verse 2, "you shall not add unto the word which I command you, neither shall you diminish aught from it, that you may keep the commandments of Yahweh your God, which I command you." That you may keep, shamar, that you may hedge those commandments. Yahweh's laws, His commandments, statutes, and judgments need to be protected. They need to be hedged from those who would do violence to them. Beware of such prophets who would make you to forget Yahweh and His laws. Anytime you hear some preacher putting down Yahweh's laws, it should set off a warning in your head. Warning, warning, warning! Let it be so. Earlier in Deuteronomy, there's a similar warning given specifically to the Israelites who escaped Egypt slavery. It's not necessarily a general warning specifically, but it's a similar warning to the same one we read in Deuteronomy 8. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Now, although not specifically made to this generation of Israelites or Celto-Saxons, the principle of what's found in this particular passage is still relevant to us today. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 9. Verse 4, it says, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God is one Yahweh, and thou shalt love Yahweh thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thy house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thy eyes, and thou shalt write them upon the post of thy house and on thy gates. In other words, do everything you possibly can to love and remember Yahweh. We're not literally put little boxes on our foreheads and little scripture passages tied to our wrists. They're to be a part of our life as they would be in our hands, to be on our hearts and our minds, to be in the very essence of what we do and believe in serving and loving Yahweh. Continuing, verse 10. And it shall be, when Yahweh thy God shall have brought thee into the land which he sware unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give thee great and goodly cities which thou buildest not, and houses full of all good things which thou findest not, that which thou fillest not, and wells digged, and thou diggest not, vineyards and olive trees which thou plantest not, when thou shalt have eaten and be full, verse 12, the first part, then beware, lest you forget Yahweh. Same warning for a different reason. Let me ask you, is that warning any less pertinent today than it was in that day? It may not have been a general warning because it's talking about that land in Canaan, but it is any less pertinent for us today? Do we not have the exact same problem today? Wealth has a tendency, as ironic as it may seem, but wealth has a tendency to breed self-reliance, forgetfulness, and ingratitude. When you think it'd do just the opposite. Receive a present, you think you'd become grateful for it. Not so when it comes to the gifts of Yahweh. It has a tendency to breed self-reliance, forgetfulness, and ingratitude. America needs to beware, needs to take heed, needs to repent in our prosperity, even in our imaginary pseudo-prosperity. Because we've been so brainwashed that we think we're richer than we actually are, when it's just a facade for the most part. But even in our pseudo-prosperity, most have forgotten Yahweh. They don't thank Him for it. They just enter into these homes and enter into this prosperity and never give Yahweh a second thought. We need to remember the admonition of Luke chapter 12 and verse 15, where it says, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth." We might also be prudent to follow in the footsteps of Agur, who was responsible for writing Proverbs chapter 30. Verses 8 and 9, he said, "Remove far from me vanity and lies. Give me neither poverty nor riches." He was a humble man. I wonder how many of us would want to pray such a prayer. Give me neither. We'd want to pray, "Give me neither poverty." But how many of us would want to pray, "Give me neither poverty nor wealth"? But he understood. He says, "Feed me not with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is Yahweh? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of God in vain." Maybe we should follow in the footsteps of Agur. Not too many of us have to worry probably about the prosperity side. But if prosperity comes our way, we need to understand that we need to be careful. Warning, warning, warning. It needs to set off a warning in our minds. Let's face it, there are few who can handle prosperity properly. Isn't that what Yeshua warned us about when he said that it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven? Wasn't impossible. The apostle said, "Well, then, how in the world?" And especially if you're thinking of an eye of a needle, I think the eye of the needle in that day meant something other. It was a small opening in the city that only a very small camel could get through. But even if you're thinking it's an eye of a needle, you'd certainly respond to the apostles did and say, "Well, then, what rich man can enter the kingdom?" God said, "Of course, what's impossible with men is possible with God. It's possible, but it's not easy to be a man of great wealth." Again, a lot of us don't have to worry about that. But it's difficult to be a man of great wealth and to enter the kingdom of heaven, to already even be thankful, to not forget Yahweh in your wealth. Wealth, of course, is not sinful in and of itself. unless it causes you to forget Yahweh. Be warned, nothing, and I mean nothing, can compare with the knowledge of Yahweh Himself. Let's move on to the New Testament warnings. There are three different Greek words translated as beware in the New Testament, and two of those words are also translated as take heed. The warnings issued in the New Testament can be classified into two categories: warnings against others and warnings against ourselves. Let's begin with warnings against others. There are three groups of people whom Yahweh tells us to beware of: false prophets, Pharisees, and scribes. We're all familiar, I think, with Matthew chapter 7 and verse 15, where it says, "Beware of the false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves." We're familiar with that. That's a fairly familiar passage for just the average person calling himself Christians. We're familiar with it, but how many actually are heeding the warning? And you'd think that people would want to heed that warning. Beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but instead are ravenous wolves. You know, you think most people are more concerned with literal wolves today who probably would very seldom, if ever, harm a human being than what they are with the false prophets, the ravening wolves in sheep's clothing in their midst. They just don't seem to care. We have more churches in America full of more people listening to more false teachers than any time in our history today. It's gotten worse instead of better. False teachers who refuse to even teach the biblical plan of salvation as taught in the Bible or in the New Testament, let alone the deeper things of God's Word. And it seems the more false they get, the more bizarre, the more idiotic, the more hypocritical, the more likely they're to be followed. Don't forget what we're told again in Jeremiah chapter 5 and verse 31. The prophets prophesy falsely, and the priests bear rule by their own means, and my people love to have it so. Need I remind you of the likes of Jimmy and Tammy Faker, Oral Roberts and Jimmy Swaggart? You know, I don't even need to make mention of their escapades. I just simply need to mention their names to you, and every one of you, all of their shenanigans, their individual shenanigans come to mind, don't they, by those names. And yet how many thousands of people still insist on following those charlatans? You think, now, I don't know what to think. You know, it's amazing, and that's putting it very lightly. But don't think that this warning is just for the more extreme type of false prophets. Since so many people today during this campaign year seem to be so taken with Ralph Reed. You know who Ralph Reed is? The executive director of the Christian Coalition, young man, nice-looking man that's very, very eloquent. He's impressive when he's being interviewed on TV and gets a lot of TV time. He works with Pat Robertson. Ralph Reed. Well, since he has taken so many, or so many people are taken with him during this campaign year, when he seems to be being so effective for the cause of Christianity, let me use him as an example. Ralph Reed is quoted in the April 7th, 1995 Jewish Bulletin. Here's how the bulletin reads. Quote, "During his speech to the ADL and during a follow-up question period with three Jewish journalists, Reed said it is a quote within a quote, blatant wrong, end of quote within a quote, for conservative evangelical Christians to call America a quote within a quote Christian nation, end of quote within a quote, and pledged to work to the end of that practice." Continuing, quote within a quote, "The Christian Coalition believes in a nation that is not officially Christian, Jewish, or Muslim," end of quote within a quote, he said. Quote within a quote, "a nation where the separation of church and state as an institution is separate and inviolable," end of quote within a quote and end of quote. Warning. Ralph Reed is anti-Christian America. He's promoting pluralism and idolatry and separation of church and state. So what, let me ask you, what makes him any different from the rest? Now, there is no question that we have dogs in America to contend with. What do I mean by that? Well, Paul in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 2, he warns us. He said, beware of the dogs. Beware of the evil workers. Beware of the false circumcision. We know that in Matthew chapter 15, Yeshua identified the Canaanites as dogs. Matter of fact, the Canaanite woman he was doing that with identified herself as coming from a nation of what would be considered dogs. Israel was considered sheep, and the Canaanites were considered dogs. And we know that through the Edomitic mixture into the Khazar Jews of today, that we have Canaanite blood. Esau married Canaanites. And so we've got dogs amongst us that we need to beware of. And while this is true, we need to also take heed of the warning given to us by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in his book, Warning to the West. Listen carefully to what he wrote on page 21 of his book. Quote, we have a Russian proverb, don't call a wolf to help you against the dogs. Now, keep in mind who the dogs are that we're talking about. Canaanite, Edomite, Khazars. He says, we have a Russian proverb, don't call a wolf to help you against the dogs. Who are the wolves in the scriptures? Don't call a wolf to help you with the dogs. If dogs are attacking and tearing at you, fight against the dogs. But don't call a wolf for help. Because when the wolves come, they will destroy the dogs or drive them away. But they will tear you apart as well. End of quote. You know, Christians today want to look to Pat Robertson and Ralph Reed and their likes as some kind of saviors, when in fact they're nothing but wolves in sheep's clothing. They are the types we're warned about in Matthew 10 and verses 16 and 17, where it says, behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of them, for they will deliver you up to the councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogues. Warning, warning, warning. Mark my words. It's the kosher, conservative, Judeo or Judaized Christian leaders such as Pat Robertson, Ralph Reed, Jerry Falwell, and their types who are the wolves who will someday turn the sheep over to be slaughtered. And they're really already doing it. Anytime something comes up against the sheep, some of the true sheep, some of the true preachers of God's Word, the other preachers, the false preachers, the wolves in sheep's clothing, are immediately turning them over to Jewish-run cult awareness networks and the ADL and the B'nai B'rith and the JDL and so forth, standing against them, proclaiming against them to be something they're not. And so it's even already happening. Take heed to the admonition given to us by the Apostle John, 1 John chapter 4 and verse 1, where it says, beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits. And it's not talking about evil little demons running around. It's talking about the spirit of the man. But try the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Take warning. On to the next group that we were warned about in the New Testament. Turn to Matthew chapter 16. Matthew 16, and beginning with verse 6. I'm just going to read these because I think I'm running out of time here. Then Yeshua said unto them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And then jumping down to verse 12, it's explained. Then understood they how that he bade them not to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Now, most of Christendom today, of course, would probably attempt to tell you that that warning is no longer applicable to us because we don't have Pharisees amongst us anymore. But that simply is not true. They thrive today only under a different name. They're not called Pharisees. But they thrive today and are influencing most everything in our life from behind the scenes. Listen to the following admission by Chief Rabbi Louis Finkelstein, who in 1937 was chosen by the Kehillah as one of the top 120 Jews representing the light of Judaism. Or in other words, or put another way, he was considered one of Judaism's experts. So if you want to know about Judaism, he's a good fellow to listen to. Here's what he said in his book, The Pharisees, speaking of the Pharisees, the sociological background of their faith. In volume 1, on Roman numeral 21, he said this, quote, Phariseeism became Talmudism. Talmudism became medieval rabbinism, and medieval rabbinism became modern rabbinism. But throughout these changes of name, ellipsis, the spirit of the ancient Pharisee survives unaltered. When the Jew, ellipsis, you know what ellipsis is? I didn't for years. It's that dot, dot, dot means that you're leaving out some. When the Jew, ellipsis, studies the Talmud, he is actually repeating the arguments used in the Palestinian academies. Ellipsis, from Palestine to Babylonia, from Babylonia to North Africa, Italy, Spain, France, and Germany, from these to Poland, Russia, and Eastern Europe, generally ancient Phariseeism has wandered. End of that quote. And then from Volume 2, page 622, he wrote, Rabbinic Judaism, the firstborn child of Phariseeism, remains until this day. End of quote. What? In other words, Judaism today is one and the same as Phariseeism of Christ's day, which I think probably all of you here are already aware of. Actually, the Jews of today, not being true Israelites, are actually better described by Yeshua, or those described by Yeshua in Matthew 23. In Matthew 23 and verse 15, he says, Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you compass sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he is made, you make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves. What we have today is not true Israelites. We have the proselytes who are twice the sons of hell as those Christ dealt with in his day. At least those who had Israelite blood running through their veins at least still had the laws of God written on their hearts and minds, even though it had been corrupted by the Talmudism or the traditions of the elders that came out of the Babylonian captivity. At least they still had a semblance of God's law left. Whereas today, those who follow those traditions, what's known as the Talmud today, have nothing to per se to stop them from going completely astray from God's law, because they're not even Israelites with the laws written on their hearts. And so they're twice the sons of hell. And so that's who we're really dealing with. Thus, if Yeshua were ushering the same warning in today's vernacular, rather than saying, beware of the Pharisees or Sadducees, today he would declare, beware of the leaven of Judaism. Or, simply, the leaven of the Jews. But no one's heeding the warning, are they? Or at least very few. It's what Paul also warned us of in Titus 1 in verse 14. Where he said not to give heed to Jewish fables and the commandments of men that turn from the truth. But once again, is anyone heeding the warning? Well, yes, there are. And there's more all the time. However, the vast majority of Christendom have recklessly disregarded this particular warning. And part of it because they no longer know who to identify as Pharisees today. That's been hidden from them, of course, the enemies of truth and even those who are behind the pulpits. But they disregard, for whatever reason, they have recklessly disregarded this warning, inasmuch as that they even call themselves Judeo or Judaized Christians. Warning, warning, warning. If we don't heed the warning, we will continue to see the fulfillment of such prophecies as provided to us by General Cornwallis and Rabbi Martin Siegel, following General Cornwallis's surrender to General George Washington at Yorktown. You've heard this before, but let me share it with you again. Cornwallis warned Washington with the following words, or prediction, quote, A holy war will now begin in America, or on America, and when it is ended, America will be supposedly the citadel of freedom. But her millions will unknowingly be loyal subjects to the crown. And then he said, Your churches will be used to teach the Jews religion. And in less than 200 years, well, we're beyond 200 years, but in less than 200 years, the whole nation will be working for divine world government. End of quote. That man was inspired. He may have lost the war, but he was inspired in his warning or his prediction to General George Washington. Nearly 200 years later, Rabbi Martin Siegel quoted in the New York magazine, January 18, 1972, declared, quote, "I am devoting my lecture in this seminar to a discussion of the possibility that we are now entering a Jewish century, a time when the spirit of the community, the non-ideological blend of the emotional and rational, and the resistance to categories and forms will emerge through the forces of anti-nationalism to provide us with a new kind of society. I call this process the Judaization of Christianity, because Christianity will be the vehicle through which this society becomes Jewish." End of quote. Also, Jewish author Marcus Eli Ravage, in an article in the February 1928 Century magazine entitled "A Real Case Against the Jews, One of Them Points Out the Full Depth of Their Guilt," stated this, quote, "You make much noise and fury about the undue Jewish influence in your theaters and movie palaces. Very good, granted your complaint is well-founded, but what is that compared to our staggering influence in your churches, your schools, your laws, and your governments, and the very thoughts you think every day, each day?" End of his quote. To a large extent, it's already happened. Now again, everything's going wrong just right. It's by God's hand. You know, as one preacher once stated, you know, a good shepherd always needs some good dogs nipping at the heels of the sheep to keep them near the shepherd. And that's what God, obviously, one of the reasons God is allowing it to happen. But it's happened. What used to be known as Christianity is now called Judeo-Christianity, and if this process of Judaization is not halted, then it will become known simply as Judaism. People, it's past time to heed the warning, and it's time to turn things back around. The last group of people the New Testament warns us against is the scribes. We'll need to cover this quickly. Mark chapter 12. How much time do I have? Mark 12, 38 through 40. You thought I was quick before. Let's get with it. "And he said unto them in this his doctrine, Beware of the scribes which love to go in long clothing, and love salutations in the marketplaces, and the chief seats in the synagogues, and the uppermost rooms at feasts, which devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. These shall receive greater damnation." In actuality, the scribes at the time of Christ were one and the same as with the Pharisees. Or more specifically, they were some of the elite, or the more powerful of the Pharisees. Now, although not expressly applicable to the media or the scribes of today, nonetheless, the warning certainly still fits the media of today as well. And it is interesting that many of the very same people that we've just talked about are in the places of power, or the seats of authority in the media as well, in this area of influence in our lives. Once again, few heed the warning. The modern scribes, rather than even placing themselves in the chief seats, are willingly placed there in the minds of the people who follow them. Rather than being beware, they make gospel out of what the media prints or says, quote unquote gods. Well, since most people make gods out of the Mediaites, not Midianites, but Mediaites, and since they're not likely to believe anyone else, let's get it straight from one of them. The following is a quote from a speech of retiring editor John Swinton, made in 1914 before the publishers, editors of the American and journalists and reporters attending the 1914 annual dinner of the American Press Association. He said this, among other things, quote, "There is no such thing as an independent press in America. If we accept that of a little country, if we accept that of little country towns, you know that I know that. Not a man among you dares to utter that his honest opinion. Were you to utter it, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. I am paid $150 a week so that I may keep my honest opinion out of the newspaper for which I write. You too are paid similar salaries or similar services. Were I to permit that a single edition of my newspaper contained an honest opinion, my occupation, like Othello's, would be gone in less than 24 hours. The man who would be so foolish as to write his honest opinion would soon be on the streets in search of another job. It is the duty of the New York journalist to lie, to distort, to revile, to toady at the feet of the mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread, or what amounts to the same thing, his salary. You are the tools and the vessels of the rich behind the scenes. We are marionettes. These men pull the strings and we dance. Our time, our talents, our lives, our capabilities are all the properties of these men. We are intellectual prostitutes. End of that quote. It's like the cartoon I saw, a man who's bringing in his TV for the TV repair, and he says to the repairman, he says, my picture's always distorted. And the repairman says back to them, well, do you watch anything other than the news? Well, you can't hardly find it anywhere else either. It's nearly all distorted. What every Mediaite worshiper should know is that their quote-unquote gods will turn on them in a moment's notice if it so benefits them for so doing. Warning, warning, warning. Beware of the lying words and pens of the scribes. However, do not fear them. They're only words, and by fearing them, you simply empower them. They may sway public opinion, but they do not sway God's opinion. Which is more important? In conclusion, be warned. Like it or not, that is some of that which the Scriptures do warn us about. I can't guarantee that you'll heed the warning, but it is my duty to blow the trumpet. In the next message, we'll take a look at that which the Bible warns us to beware of about ourselves, which may even be more important. Let's stand and close in prayer.